being lost and feeling lost is, it's like a birthright. It's a feature of life, not a flaw. The thing about the middle space, this liminal space, is that you're not who you used to be. But I think, as you pointed out, you're also not who you're going to be. How do you use curiosity to guide your next step? Lao Tzu says, nature isn't in a hurry, yet everything is accomplished. To think that we have one speed and it's go, which instinctively doesn't make any sense to me. What gets in the way of you being at your best? What are the behaviors? What are the patterns? What are the stories? What are the beliefs that block you from fully expressing your truest, best self?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Steve Schlafman. Steve is a venture capitalist turned transition coach. We talk about lostness, transformation, curiosity, mindfulness practices, his new downshift program, being a husband and father, and more. Please enjoy. So we'll say there was this particular transformation that took almost a decade. Mm-hmm. I also feel like I'm in the depths of kind of a transitionary period. I wrote this piece last year. Was the first thing I wrote in a while that I titled Transformation Purgatory, which is basically mm-hmm. this feeling that we know this change is coming, but we're kind of in this state of limbo. A couple of questions around this. One is, why are these transformations so long? And do they have to be that way? Or is there something we can do to accelerate them?
Yeah, it's interesting because certainly with my own journey, there have been certain transformations that in the moment have felt very, very rapid, but then over longer time frames, they felt longer, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. like, for example, getting sober for me happened within a year. And from learning meditation in August of 2014 to then getting sober in June of 2015, that's a pretty fast transformation from meditation to sobriety in a year for the most part. But then when you look at the full transformation that started with that to where I am now, that took almost 10 years. And so I think that's the thing about change that often is hard to predict. I think for some people, there are certain kinds of change that can happen really fast where there's like a significant turning point, someone dying, a loved one dying, getting a terminal illness, diagnosis, to losing your job. These can be very shocking. Whereas there are others that are just more gradual as people peel back the layers and learn more about themselves and enter into sort of the second half of life, these changes can be more deliberate. So I think it depends on the person. It depends on the context. But certainly in my case, I've seen it happen in both ways.
And as you're saying that, I'm realizing there's also this nesting of transformation, right? The sobriety meditation discreetly, sobriety discreetly fit into this larger, they're kind of like concentric circles of transformation that's happening. So that yeah. makes sense as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, what's interesting, and this is a big part of my philosophy, is that, I think this is at least the story I tell myself, is that a lot of people look at meditation and they imagine like a guru that's mind is super calm, and they try to pick up meditation and they're like, my mind won't stop. There's something wrong with me. I don't know what I'm doing. And fortunately for me, as very early in my meditation journey, it's like, yes, I was practicing transcendental meditation. I did transcend, and there were moments of clarity and calmness. But for me, it was the metacognition, the ability to actually start to watch my thoughts and watch myself kind of in the context of a variety of environments. To me, that was the thing that really catalyzed my transformation, specifically starting with sobriety, because at a certain point, if I was smoking weed in the morning or during the day and being hungover the next, it's like in your meditating and you're watching your thoughts, it's almost impossible to hide from that. And so for me, I sort of view that a lot of transformation can stem from some sort of practice of mindfulness or contemplative practices, because it helps cultivate that awareness, that presence, that then creates an opportunity to start to question some things, and then ultimately leads to some agency.
I think you just answered my next question, but want to double click on that in case there's more. During these transformational periods that feel long, and you know you're in the midst of, and you feel like, I just want to get to the end of this, what should you be trying to tune into and learn and cultivate in that process? Is it that awareness? Is it being in tune with yourself, listening to what your body, your emotions, your mind are telling you? Is it to have a sense of like non-grasping, of letting go? What do you feel like you should be focused on, for lack of a better term, during that transformational process?
Yeah, I recently wrote a piece on understanding and navigating lostness, like these, to use your words, these transitional periods, that liminal space, as a lot of people call it. What I would say is it does start with awareness and presence. And I also believe it's important to note that we are conditioned by the culture that we've been raised in, especially if, you know, for those listening, predominantly Western audience, is that we can't stop. We need to move through, like, don't feel your feelings, just push through and get to the next thing. And what I've begun to realize is that when we are lost, it's actually slowing down. It's the same advice that a wilderness guide would give someone if they're lost in the woods, which is stay still, do nothing, stand still, as David Wagner, the poet, said, and begin to listen. Calm your nervous system. Start to be able to access the higher functioning areas of your brain. And so what I would say is it starts with that. And then oftentimes, and this is something that I'm really passionate about in helping people determine, is, well, what are the behavior patterns, the beliefs, the stories that we tell ourselves that keep us from wanting to be in that state of lostness? And for everybody, lostness can mean different things. For some people, lostness could be, or the desire to emerge from lostness as fast as possible could be based on the family they were raised in and what their financial situation was, and, you know, being afraid of running out of money and not having security. For someone else, it might be their ambition isn't being properly utilized, and that's they're unable to put a dent in the universe at this given time. And so point is there's a whole host of behavior, stories, patterns that force us into wanting to leave this state. And I was actually having a conversation with a good friend of mine, Andy Johns, who's actually going to be one of the expert lecturers for Downshift. And he was saying that he calls it professional spiritual bypassing, which I laughed at this terminology, which is when we are in these liminal spaces, what we often do is we quickly grasp for the next project or the next achievement, so that we don't actually have to face our reality of not necessarily knowing. And so we just quickly move into the next thing. And to be fair, I've experienced this in my own 7-year journey of when I decided to step back. Immediately my mind is looking at all these different projects, all these different ideas, and it very quickly wants to get out of that mode. So there's a bunch of other techniques and tools that I suggest beyond the identification of being lost and slowing down. Certainly there's the wanting to understand what's behind the lostness. And then third is, like, what I like to say is find the through lines. Like, what are those things in your life that are going to be the thread that connects the past, the present, and the future. So these could be your values, passions, and interests, and relationships. And so these are really powerful ways to ground you in these moments of change and transition.
The use of lostness is fascinating to me. It implies intentionally this idea of like shedding an identity, shedding the known, and moving towards, again, being in this liminal space between A and B. Why do you use that word in particular instead of something that speaks to like maybe the other side of that, like the awakening or the arrival or what have you? Why do you feel like lostness is the right term in this scenario?
I think there's a variety of terms that we can use. You know, certainly if you look at liminality, right, in that being in that middle space, again, in our society, it's very uncomfortable for people to be there. Lostness is one way to describe it. Disorientation is another one. Because the thing about the middle space, this liminal space, is that you're not who you used to be. But I think, as you pointed out, you're also not who you're going to be. Like, you know that change is coming. You know that there's going to be a new expression of yourself, of your life. And in that space, it's like, well, I don't really know who I am, and I don't know who I'm becoming, and I'm not who I was, who I used to be. And so it just becomes this really, it's a word that I'm looking for, very, very unforgiving space. And the thing is, and this ties to the work of William Bridges, who wrote the seminal book on transitions probably 30 or 40 years ago. But what he would say in that book is like, when we move from an ending into this middle phase, like there's a number of things that happen. So the first thing that happens is it's like almost like we're detaching from the world that we came from. So in my case, previously it was venture investing. So at first I detach from it. Then there's like a dismantling, and that dismantling is removing all the habits, you know, the structures that sort of held up your day, maybe a bunch of the relationships. Then the next phase is almost like disidentifying with that old persona, with that old life, where your identity starts to morph. And for a lot of people, this can be very unsettling. And then the one that I really like also is disenchantment, where now that there's distance between your old life and the world that you came from and the life that you're living now, you can start to actually question the stories and perspectives that you once had. In my case, going from investing into coaching full time, I started to look at the venture investing profession, which I have lots of friends in the business still, and obviously believe it's a necessary piece of the capital stack to fund innovation. Now, that said, it's not for every business. And for many years, I had this belief that venture was the end all be all, the best way to fund a business. And now, because I have distance from that business, I now recognize that and understand it. And then the last thing that happens, which I touched on a little bit earlier, in terms of the five things that happen at these ending, is this disorientation. So what happens is there's this culmination of all these things, and you're like, okay, like I no longer have the structure, I no longer have my identity, I'm starting to see through all these beliefs that I once had, and like I also don't know who I'm becoming. And the only way to process it is disorientation. And so what do we do in these cases? We either hit rewind and we go back to the way things were because it's safe and comfortable, or we hit fast forward so that we don't actually have to sit in the unknown. And so there's all these behavior patterns that are largely context dependent on the person that ultimately drives that desire to speed up, right? To go faster, to move through the space. And so part of what we're trying to do at Downshift is help people understand these patterns that really make it very difficult for great reasons to be able to slow down in these moments of change. And it doesn't mean that it's going to feel good or be easy, but there are ways to move through it that create a little bit more of a sense of grounding.
The division of or identification of those steps helps kind of me orient where, ironically, given the use of the word disorienting, orient in terms of where I'm at in the process. So that's useful.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're going to get into downshift in a minute, but I wanted to.
Well, can I make one last point about lossless?
Go for it.
Because I think it's an important distinction to make. And I actually wrote about this a long time ago in my first piece on lossness, which was in June of 2022. I went on a 5-day meditation retreat at the Garrison Institute on the banks of the Hudson River, gorgeous, gorgeous old seminary that they converted into a Buddhist retreat center. And the second night I was there, it wasn't a silent retreat. The second night I was there, I was talking to a 70-year-old psychoanalyst that's one of the most well-known psychoanalysts in New York City. And he and I are talking about our respective professions. And this guy is really at the top of it. And he said to me, you know, I'm 70 years old and I still feel lost. Like, I still feel like I don't know what I'm doing. And in that moment, it was like a light bulb where I was like, oh, here's a guy that is top of his field, who's in his 70s, you know, on the verge of retirement, and he feels lost. And it was just such a great reminder that this idea of lostness isn't just about navigating liminal space. It's also around, like, you can lose your wits, you can lose your mojo, you can lose your motivation. You know, you can lose a relationship, you can lose a person. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to say is, given that we live in a world that's in constant flux and change, and I would even argue that's speeding up for a whole bunch of reasons, being lost and feeling lost is almost like a birthright. It's as I like to say, it's a feature of life, not a flaw.
Yeah, it's the natural way of being. It's the norm. It's the desire within us to attach to things and organize things and maintain stasis that conflicts with that. Yeah.
And all lostness and the essence of lostness is that we will have certain expectations and desires. It's kind of getting to the core of Michael Singer's work, but we have expectations and desires and attachments. And when reality delivers us something that isn't in line with that, we're averse to it.
Right. Our prediction mechanism raises a flag and says, nope, this doesn't fit.
Yeah, because all of our old maps say it should fit. This should fit. And it should be a certain way. But in reality, there's a different reality.
That's excellent. In this process of transformation, and I sense this in you, I hope I'm not projecting this, I think you've said this elsewhere, but I get the impression that you're very analytical too, in your head a lot.
I am a head type. I'm an Enneagram type 7.
Right. That's what I remember reading. And so I found that, although in some cases this is very useful when used appropriately, I spend too much time in my head thinking and rethinking. And there's this other side, in some cases, some people look at this as the division between the hemispheres. But there's so much more knowledge in, like, our intuitive kind of latent under the surface understanding of things. And so how do you tap into that more? And second, how do you get the best out of both the combination of, like, the more heady and the feelings components?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say if I think about it on my journey of transformation, for almost the first 4 or 5 years, even though I was in a bunch of different coaching trainings, it wasn't until I started to study with a conscious leadership group with Jim Detmer and Diana Chapman. I participated in their 12-month coaching training program. And it wasn't until I did that where I really understood to the extent of which I was living in my head, despite, you know, thousands of hours of meditation practice. And what then happened was, is I was able, through help of going through that program, a lot of practice, was actually find ways to start to cultivate interoception. And through, you know, and I've been on a number of Vipassana meditation retreats. And so through embodiment practices like yoga, like Vipassana, like Tai Chi, Qigong, to really get into my body. And the more that I was able to do that, the more I was able to almost like naturally go with the current of life in a very different way. Because the deeper I went into my body, and as parts of my body that were literally somatically armored started to open up, it was almost like I had this third sense, that like the sixth sense is a better way to, the sixth sense that was now coming online, that I was like, wow, I didn't even really know. I didn't even know that I had this opportunity to live life where it's not just like thinking, which is really helpful, but that there's a way to like feel and sense your way through based on your energy, your curiosity, and being able to feel in your body where there's a contraction and where there's like an opening starts to be really instinctive on how to move forward and what to spend your time on and who to spend your time with. And it just becomes a very different orientation when you start to inhabit your body. And so it's been beautiful. I would say like that's one of the biggest unexpected benefits. And I think there's actually one point worth making is I talked about that meditation retreat that I went on at the Garrison Center where I had that encounter with Jonathan, the psychoanalyst. That whole experience was based on Tonglen meditation, which is this idea of it's basically a Tibetan Buddhist form of meditation that's basically called the idea is you take in suffering from other people. And then you take it in, and then you give love and compassion for them.
Mm.
And it was basically like 5 days of Tonglen meditation of like imagining suffering of other human beings and then giving them love and compassion and kindness. It was this constant. And what I realized is that my heart opened. And I had this experience where I began to actually feel my heart, and not like intellectually feel it, but like really somatically feel it. And I just had this like huge emotional release where I just burst out crying in my room, like rolling around on my bed during one of the breaks, where I was like, oh my God, I haven't had access to my heart, and there's so much that I want to give to the world. And so I share this powerful experience that I had at this retreat, that like there's no way I could have predicted that like this would have happened. And now I can sit in a meditation and clearly feel my heart, right? I can be in a conversation like this where there's depth and connection and feel warmth in my solar plexus. And so the point is it's like it's an unraveling, but really tapping into the intelligence of the body, and the emotions and the intellect, that becomes a trifecta that's really powerful and the most beautiful way.
I think you touched on the most difficult piece for me historically, which is that there is a fake tapping into your feelings that you get from trying to intellectualize the heart, which is what I tend to do. And so really like cutting through that, getting to the core is easier said than done.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I think a lot of research, you know, Lisa Feldman Barrett out of Northeastern University, need to give her a plug because I'm a fellow Husky myself, went there for school, but, you know, what I think she would say is that emotions actually originate in the body. And it's our, like, it's almost like our ability to kind of intellectualize and label those sensations as emotions versus like, this is the emotion and this is how it shows up in the body.
Right.
And so for me, what I've tried to do as I've gone deeper into my body in these practices is rather than trying to attach labels to how I'm feeling, is just being with those sensations. And then as my teacher, Jim, taught me is then how do I express those emotions and let them move through me rather than trying to intellectualize them, stuff them down or be like, oh, I'm noting it and now I can move on. And because that just ultimately becomes a form of bypassing.
A few moments ago, you mentioned the term curiosity. And I know that's mm-hmm. one of your three kind of core values you've landed on, along yeah. with it's a connection. And I'm forgetting the third one off the top of my head.
And creation.
And creation. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Curiosity and community are featured heavily in like all of my bios across social media. So I resonate with those two thirds in it. And in fact, I see creation as downstream of curiosity in many cases. So it's all intertwined. What is the role of curiosity in all of this? Because I've become fixated on curiosity recently. I think it is one of, if not the most kind of powerful tool, in the universe. I mean, as far as humans are concerned, I think it is all innovation, all advancement seems to be downstream of genuine human curiosity. But what role do you feel like that plays in terms of this transformational process?
Yeah, well, I think there's different layers of curiosity. So you could be curious about other people. So you're in a conversation with someone. Like I, you know, as a coach, I'm having lots of conversations and just be like, oh, I want to be really curious and understand someone. I want to understand where they're coming from. You know, why do they see the world and in the way that they do? We could go pull that thread. So there's sort of curiosity about people. There's curiosity about the world. So could be like I'm walking. Here's a great example. I'm walking down the street. This was last spring. And all of a sudden, it sounds like something's raining. And I'm in the woods. And I'm like, there's something going on in nature that I don't know what it is. But there, because I've never heard it. And perfectly blue skies. Sounds like it's raining. And sure enough, I go down a rabbit hole. And it turns out there's these moths that are basically hatching. And it happens once every like 8 to 10 years. And anyhow, so like that's an example where you're just moving through the world and you have an inquiry and you're like, huh, I want to go find this out. And then there's inquiry about a curiosity about yourself. Huh. When I'm on Twitter, I always sense negativity. What's that about? Or, I get stoned every single night I get home. Makes me wonder what's really going on. And so point is that there's different lenses, like different ways to direct, like to feel into our curiosity. And to me, it's an essential ingredient for anyone that is trying to ultimately determine what their next step is. And notice what I didn't say is like their life purpose. It's how do you use curiosity to guide your next step? And I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why our society doesn't think that way. And this idea of like, not wanting to make mistakes but it's how can you curiosity just guide each step of the way of a process of a journey, versus like having to find the perfect thing and have the right answer. But curiosity is really, really critical for sort of navigating that path.
In the midst of a transformation, I think more generally in life, for people who have some kind of like spiritual practice. I found there's a tendency for people to become very engrossed in these practices, these prescriptions, these rituals, to the point where that becomes the thing. I mean, that this is the whole concept of like the finger pointing at the moon, that replaces the actual thing. And that's frankly why, although I've dabbled with meditation, I've dabbled with yoga and other things, I'm very weary of them. And people who kind of espouse them as the thing, like that I am a coach of this thing, I am a shaman of this thing. Mm-hmm. And yet I sense value in them. And so I'm trying to figure out how you know how to best engage with those practices, understanding they're a means to the end and not the end in and of themselves, and identify and kind of pull back when that does become the end. And if you've seen this in your own life or in the lives of the people you coach, and how to navigate that.
I would say that I have a tendency, so I want to first speak from my own experience, where I have a tendency to really get excited about things, the Enneagram 7 in me, where I'll throw myself in, and in a very short period of time, I'll get to like that 80% threshold of like, and that's happened with meditation. It's happened with cycling. It's happened in so many different sobriety, right? If sobriety was a sport, for the first 2 years, I was crushing. Right. And what I ultimately have discovered in my own life is that each one individually has redeeming qualities, right? Has the light, the positive, but just like anything, there's a shadow to these practices as well. And I think we see it now with, like, I'm just going to pick on one, you know, sort of emerging field, is psychedelic medicine work. So much beauty in that work. You know, I've had some of the most profound experiences in my life on medicine. And there's also a dark side to that. And so I think anytime we step into these modalities, I think there's an opportunity to embrace them while also holding some level of skepticism. It's actually why, you know, the book Awareness, Anthony DeMello, great book. You know, he talks about, you know, the Buddha that would say, well, don't take my word. Right? Don't, like, I want you to inspect it the way that a goldsmith would inspect a raw piece of gold. And so I think we all have a responsibility to both appreciate these practices that we've integrated into our lives while also, like, inspecting them. And for me, you know, I think there's been a bunch of changes in my life where, again, like, sobriety was a big part. I went to AA meetings 3 or 4 times a week. I haven't been to an AA meeting probably in 6 months. You know, I'll go occasionally because I love the community and the group and the stories, and it's such a powerful reminder. But there are just other elements of it that just don't align with my philosophy. And so I think I think I made my point here. But yeah, just a healthy level of skepticism, and knowing that, like anything, life is going to unfold. You're going to change. People are going to change. And, you know, something might really speak to you at this season of life, and something will likely replace it down the road.
Right. I said we would loop back around to downshift. So I want to dig into that a bit more now. Although I know in pre-recording, I had said to you, we don't have to get into the background on things. This might actually be the exception to that. And you can give a few sentences on what exactly downshift is. And then I would, in addition to that, the question I would pose to you is, and we talked about this a little bit at the beginning as well, but everything around us, especially I think for you and I, or at least your background being in tech and VC, I'm in tech as well. Everything around us says accelerate. You can point to more recently the phrase and movement of like effective acceleration within AI that's gained a lot of momentum. Yeah. And at the end of the day, kind of the story of humanity, or one of the key stories of humanity, this through line has been always progress and innovation, pushing forward, the pioneer kind of archetype. Is, once you give this background on Downshift, is it antithetical to that? Or is there a difficult reconciliation of these things? Or is it simply a temporary phase in a larger picture of acceleration?
Yeah, well, I like to look to nature for inspiration. That's where I get a lot of inspiration. And, you know, Lao Tzu says, nature isn't in a hurry, yet everything is accomplished, something to that effect. And I love that because, you know, it's part of the reason why we left New York City and moved upstate to the Hudson Valley, is to be embedded in nature. And what you notice is that we're embedded in these cycles, right? These cycles of renewal and creation, cycles of growth, cycles of disillusion and destruction and resting, right? Just look at the seasons is like obviously the clear metaphor. And so to think that we have one speed and it's go, which instinctively doesn't make any sense to me, mm-hmm. right? Because we're nature, we're animals. I think people often forget that, but we're literally mammals. And if you look at animals, there is bursts of movement, energy, activity, followed by rest, recovery. And so I just want to start by saying that. So I look to nature. And so to me, it's like, well, if we're fully expressing our nature, then what makes sense? And I think this progress narrative that we've developed is clearly, and I'm a capitalist, so I'll be the first to admit it, but it's what happens in a highly capitalist society that is clearly wanting people to push and progress and, you know, and move great American experiment forward. Again, I benefit from this. So I'm not being overly critical. I'm a participant, yet there are drawbacks to this. And so for me, what I've ultimately noticed, and it took a long time and a lot of deprogramming and therapy and coaching and medicine work, is that when I actually slowed down, beginning with my meditations in 2014, is when I actually started to know who I was. It was when I was able to start to question like the scripts that I've been handed by my family, by my society, by the groups I'm part of. And what I realized is that it wasn't necessarily the right thing for me. You know, I wrote this a long time ago, just because you can do something and you're effective at it doesn't mean it's still the right thing for you to do. And so that's what I think like slowing down allows us to, is start to just listen, start to get to know ourselves. And I should say, for a lot of people, that's really scary. Like it actually requires a lot of courage. It requires a lot of self-compassion, because there's a whole host of patterns. I'm actually writing a post on this about what are the patterns that keep us going, like behavior patterns. And so it requires courage and vulnerability to actually slow down. And what I've discovered in my own experience, you know, N of one, so want to be mindful of it, is that as I've slowed down, as I've listened and like become more embodied and been able to kind of sense and feel my way through, is that I've designed and created a life for myself that I couldn't have dreamed of having when I was a venture partner, like when I was a partner at a major VC firm in New York City. Like my life is 1,000 times better and I make a fraction of the money. I make a fraction, or I work a fraction of the time. And I've never been more ambitious because I'm actually doing what I love to do and what fills me up. That's really driven by my values. And so it's a long way. That's making the case for deceleration. I should also say there's more of like health. Like I've been burnt out, right? There's a reason why I was smoking weed and drinking every day is because I was going so hard and couldn't handle the pressure that I was feeling in my profession. And there are scores of workers and professionals that are in their mid-30s that have just haven't stopped. You know, I get applications for downshift. I was reading through applications last night and there was one woman who said, like, I developed an autoimmune disorder. And this is an AI researcher at one of the top companies in the world. And like I had to quit because my body was shutting down. And so I think there's also like a real health imperative for those that they're like our bodies are breaking down, our nervous systems are completely dysregulated. And because the idea of working 60, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, years on end, just I don't think that's in our true nature. Coming back to that concept.
Yeah. And yet, I think that downshifting, the title itself implies, and I like the theme, by the way, between this and your newsletter or other brand with Where the Road Bends. It creates a good little imagery in your head in terms of what's happening. But the use of downshift implies there's a time again later where you do accelerate, where you upshift again. And so I'm curious how you think about how you identify, how you know when you've done the necessary work, the requisite work to identify, okay, now is the time for me to step in to this new identity and kick things up a notch.
Yeah. So my old coach, Dr. Josh Claypow, I'm going to give him a shout out because he's awesome. He affectionately called one of my patterns blow and go. This is a very old pattern that I had most of my life where I would just like have a spark of inspiration. I wouldn't even think through the implications and I would just go. It was transferring to Northeastern. I mean, there's just countless examples throughout my career, creating the founder library. I wouldn't think through any of the implications. And then finally I'd get to a point where I'd be like, what the hell am I doing? And I wouldn't commit and I would just give it up. And so I spent a lot of time understanding those patterns that would prohibit, that would launch me in a direction and then only to not be committed to it because I wanted more optionality. I didn't want to have to choose and commit. Anyhow, what I ultimately discovered as I slowed down, starting about 3 years ago, is that I said to myself, I wasn't going to make any major decision for at least a year. All I was going to do is coach and write and be a dad. That's actually one of the best things Dr. Josh did with me was pose that question. What would it look like if you were just to coach and be a dad? And on the other end of that, of not making decisions, of sitting and waiting, is it became very clear to me when the idea of downshift came, because I had been running all of these experiments, writing, coaching, pivoted my coaching practice to focus on high performers in transition 18 months ago, reading countless books, doing trainings. And in that moment, I knew. Like there, and I'm happy to share what happened in that moment, but there's no questioning. There's like, oh, this is it. And now I'm in a season of life where I am upshifting, but that upshift is coming from a very different kind of energy than the old Steve, the blow and go. This is deliberate, thoughtful, grounded, present versus, you know, frenetic. Like I have this energy that I just need to go and create something. And so it there's a very different quality to the creation and to how I'm showing. And listen, it's not lost on me. The name of the company is Downshift. So I, in a lot of ways, and I need to be careful saying this because this is how identity can be slippery, is how can I embody this, right? Like, how can I embody the principles of Downshift while building Downshift? And I know that's kind of meta, but it's important. It's really important.
Challenging.
Yeah, and here's what I would say. I think the only way through is two things. The only way to do it, if I want to honor the way I want to build it in line with my values at this stage of life, is one of which is move the ball forward. I'm a former football player, so I often resort to this analogy. Move the ball forward a little bit every day. Be focused, while also holding a very, very long-term vision. And if I'm at this for 5 to 10 years and I move it forward and I'm ambitious and I put a lot of goodness out in the world and we create an amazing experience, like, I don't know, this is the optimist in me, but I have a hard time believing that it's not gonna have a really big impact and help a lot of people. And, you know, frankly, also, you know, be financially rewarding for my family. So I've never been as ambitious as I am now.
Yeah, I love that piece. It's counterintuitive, but it makes sense from the perspective I'm coming from. In a lot of your writing, and this is, I think, just both explicit and implicit in your write-up about Downshift and language on the website, stillness and silence, which is two words I come back to often, feature prominently. There are things we desperately need. The world is moving faster and noisier than ever. Is it even possible to really get those things while living your quote unquote normal life? Or do you have to do something like Downshift to step? And maybe even Downshift isn't enough. I know it starts with a 2-day in-person retreat, but those next 7+ weeks are still, for some people, maybe in the course of living their normal life. Do you feel like at some point you do have to take a substantial amount of time, step away to really feel those senses of stillness and silence and enter into that loss?
It's a great question. I think there's a bunch of threads we can pull on here. So I think maybe a good place to start, let's put a pin in silence and stillness just for a second.
Sure.
And I want to make a really important point. So the program is going to be 8 weeks and we're going to do a month-long integration. That's going to be much more lightweight. It'll be a few mastermind calls, community work, some additional reading, but it's going to be a much lighter lift. So it'll be 90 days altogether. That's a new wrinkle that I've designed in for very specific reasons, unannounced, but we're having this conversation. And this is the analogy that I use. If you look at an accelerator, our counterparts, right? Like we're building the antithesis of an accelerator. But if you're an entrepreneur and you join an accelerator, the expectation isn't you're going to start and exit the company in 3 months. The expectation is you're going to be in a community that's supporting the ability to form a company, hopefully get on the path to product market fit, learn a bunch of skills and tools and capabilities. And at the end of it, you're wiser. And now you got to go build your company. And so I just literally had this thought last night in bed when I couldn't sleep after my year and a half year old was up screaming. What we're doing is something similar, where you can think of what we're creating as a container to learn a lot of different methodologies and tools in the context of a container with deep reflection. But the work isn't going to be done at the end of the 3 months, right? It just gets started then. And so I want to be very clear that I see what we're building is similar in that regard, is that the journey is just starting at the end of this. But what's going to happen is you're going to have a whole new appreciation for the way you're conditioned, where you got your scripts about money, where you got your scripts about work and achievement, what you actually value. How do you know what you value? What does it feel like to actually be present? And that doesn't mean you're going to be a monk and you're going to be like the Dalai Lama and just be nothing but full unabided awareness, full abiding awareness into perpetuity. But we're going to give everybody a taste of it and little tastes of all these things. And collectively, we're making a bet that it's going to lead to some really magical changes in people. So that's the first point I want to make about the duration and how I see this. As it relates to stillness and silence, let's pick that back up, is that stillness and silence, I think for some people, that's really fucking scary. It's really scary.
Absolutely.
And what I want to do is I want to be careful to be prescriptive. That silence and stillness is mandated as part of a program. Now, will we recommend certain practices? Sure. But are we going to mandate them? No, because some people might actually cultivate presence by going to a concert or ecstatic dancing. That might be like, you're dancing, but that could be a downshift practice, right? So my job as the guide of this is to work with each individually to cultivate a series of practices in addition to the program that will help them develop presence. If that presence, like for me, it's not, oh, it's stillness and silence. The outcome that we're driving for is presence. So what are the things that bring people into their bodies that make them feel present and alive? Because once you're able to feel that, and once you're able to do that, then navigating through transition, through complexity, gets a little bit easier, because as we said, you start to develop this felt sense, this sixth sense. So I just wanted to note that. But yeah, stillness and silence is important. And there's going to be parts of the program where there will be that. But it's not our job to force it onto people. You know, we're more concerned with helping people cultivate that presence.
Good reframe. You have this excerpt where you say that the journey then moves, the journey of the program then moves towards embracing a new vision. This phase is about rediscovery. And I want to emphasize the re part here. I think it was very intentional usage. What is it that you feel like we're rediscovering but was lost or suppressed?
Yeah, so I think where I'm going is there are four phases in the program. The third phase is renewal. So in the renewal phase, there's a number of modules and sort of core ideas. One of the core ideas, it starts with values. And not like value, like, yes, I wrote my values on my office door. But like a lot of companies put their values up on the wall and then forget about them. But it's how do you know what you value, and how do you actually live them, and what are actions that are aligned with those values? So that's a very important piece of it, because we're talking about how do you get to that vision, right? Step into that new future. Then there's related to curiosity, but play, experimentation, creativity. You know, for a lot of people I work with or have met, like they don't know how to have fun anymore. They just don't. So that's a part of it. Experimentation. How do you help people run experiments? And not just like intellectually, but I say this to all my clients, when you make contact with reality or not, what do you learn about yourself? What are you avoiding, right? Like, so there's a lot that we can learn, and it's not about like these grand experiments of like, it can be very small of like, okay, I have this curiosity to go read this book or go listen to this podcast. That can be an experiment. And oh, wow, you know, I just listened to this podcast with Cal Newport talking about slow productivity. Wow, I'm really captivated by that. There's something like, where do I go next? What's the next door I open? So that's going to be a big part of it. And then moving into vision. So it's sort of values, play, curiosity, energy, like in terms of like feeling alive, joy. And then sort of on the way down, it's start to imagine some possibilities. And there's a researcher out of Stanford who I love her work, Hazel Marcus. And you know, she talks about this notion of possible selves. And Ibarra, who is a former HBS professor, wrote this great book called Working Identity, where it's like, okay, you have these possible selves or these possible visions of the future. Then what are some small steps that you start to take? And what I've noticed is, without even reading that book, that's effectively what I've been doing for the last 7 years. I went to a reboot retreat that was led by Jerry Colonna, one of my mentors. Came home from it and said to my wife, I think I want to be a coach. She's like, you're crazy. I then resigned from RRE. And I was like, I'm going to have some downtime. I think I might want to go become a coach. Like, I went and I talked to a bunch of coaches. I read a few books. Another experiment. And so the point is like very naturally, I was running these experiments that was attached to this idea of a future vision of myself. Initially, it was future vision of myself was an investor that was also a coach that blended these two worlds together. Little did I know that I on the other side of that, I was going to be like, yeah, we need to move on from this investor identity because it's not who you are at your core. And so, and then the last module on the back end of like stepping into a vision is like, in some ways it requires trust and surrender and faith. And so we'll be doing some exercises around that as well.
Surrender and faith are two explicit questions I wanted to get to around those, but we're not going to have time. So maybe we'll do it another time.
Well, we might be able to. Who knows? Let's see.
All right, let's get to the other questions I want to get to. We'll see if we've got time. You had just mentioned a second ago that your wife said you were crazy when you said you wanted to become a coach. Yeah. I've heard this elsewhere, but I know from our intro call that it seems like she's been extremely supportive in this process, especially
biggest supporter,
right? Especially as somebody who is an entrepreneur herself and has that side, that perspective of things. I think I imagine a lot of the people you're coaching with who are later stage high performers come to the table with a spouse and or kids, and so when they make these decisions about transformation, it isn't just in isolation. It's not, you know, I can turn on a dime and sell everything. There's other considerations. There's other responsibilities, whether it be to people or financial, what have you, which complicates further this process of transformation. Regarding your spouse in particular, how do you go about cultivating that trust and support from them? Because they are along for the ride in order to make that leap.
Yeah, it's interesting because Eliza would, if she were here, she would say Steve's just going to do what he wants to do. Mm. But I think that's it's not entirely true. I think like she and I have really supported each other through our journeys. You know, certainly her as an entrepreneur for over 12 years, founder and CEO of The Sill. And for us, I think it really starts with communication. And listen, with two kids in the picture, it's a constant juggling act. But for us, like, we just want each other to thrive and succeed. And I think with relationships, the best relationships, and I'm biased because this is the way that my relationship is structured, where we're able to fully express our individuality and be on that individual journey of transformation while also honoring the bond and the relationship, and being able to hold both, where we honor our individuality while also respecting the sanctity of the bond, is it's a balancing act. And we both have to, it's a give and take. And we see ourselves as like a portfolio in some ways, where, you know, like right now I'm recording this podcast, and our nanny called in sick today, and our oldest doesn't have after school, got canceled because there's parent teacher conferences tomorrow. And so Eliza stepped up. She said, "I know you have a lot going on with downshift, and I'm going to cover for you." And there were many days where I've covered for her, and like, that's what it's the thing is I think when you look at it again over a long period of time in a relationship, and there's lots of communication, and you're able to express, like for us, like we're able to very clearly express to each other when we're happy, when we're upset, when we're frustrated, when we're harboring resentment. And just to have that kind of relationship is so important. But I wouldn't have been able to get through any of these transitions without her. Like, she's been really, really supportive every step of the way. And I remember, last thing I'll say is, when I was debating between leaving investing and going into coaching full time, like I had been oscillating between these identities for 3 years, where I was in coaching and investing, and, you know, largely investing, and then largely coaching and a little bit of investing. She said, "I don't care what you choose. I don't care. I just want, like, I want you to be happy, and I want you to stop complaining." and frankly, like, she would admit this. As soon as I left investing, I stopped complaining about work. I haven't complained about work one day. And so
I can't let my wife listen to this. She's she's going to mirror all.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to hear you complain anymore. Just pick a path. And I did. And she trusted me. And to her credit, like, look, like, she could have totally been like, "Steve, as an investor, we're going to make a lot more money in this profession, and like, stay the course, and we're going to have a certain quality of lifestyle." And I married someone with really strong values that, you know, that shares my values as it comes to not having to optimize for every last dollar.
Beautiful. The other person or people in this equation that I mentioned earlier are your kids. And you had a recent tweet that resonated with me, where you said, "As a father, I'm torn between two powerful parts of myself, the part that deeply wants to be an active, present father at home, and the part that's ambitious and driven at work." And you ended it by saying, "I know I'm not the only father who feels this way." You're certainly not. I feel that way.
I'm not the only parent that feels this way. Yeah. To call in the mothers. Yes.
Yeah. In the context of this, as the fathers, how do you balance or maybe not balance, effectively fluctuate between the two?
Well, not only have I never been this ambitious in my life, but I've also never been this productive. And so I always have to remind myself, because there are times where I do feel resentment when I'm on Twitter, where it's all these single people building and tweeting about like productivity hacks and all this. And there are times where I'm like, yeah, I really wish I could work around the clock right now. That's how much excitement and energy I have. But the reality is my relationship with my kids and my role as a father, and my relationship with my wife and my role as a husband, just more important. I just know that when I'm 8 years old, God willing, I'll look back and it won't be, "Oh, I wish I worked that extra 5-hour shift." It would be like, "I'm so glad that I spent a ton of time with my kids when they were young." And so with that, and I actually have written about this, I had this experience where maybe Father's Day 1 or 2 years ago, I tweeted that I said, you know, my mission in life is to be a great father, or no, is to be the father I never had, but always wanted. And then I went through the Hoffman process last October, which was one of the best experiences of my life. And in that, I realized that that statement of I want to be the father that I always wanted but never had was coming from a place of vindictiveness, of like resentment, like almost like I'm going to fucking show you that I'm going to be a better dad than you were because you didn't fucking show up in all the ways in which you should have. Whereas the reframe, what I ultimately, what, from a place of like compassion and love was actually, I want to be a great father because I love my daughters and I want to be there for them and I want to watch them grow up. And I want to be a central figure in their life and a role model. And so I think with that said, it requires, and I'm going to come back to this, a very long-term view on building. And I have no other choice because there's only so many hours in the day and I do drop off in the morning and I pick up my daughter at in the night and then, you know, from 5:30 to 8, it's like bedtime. Sometimes bedtime goes till 9 and at 9 o'clock, if I do work, it's no more than an hour and then I'm out because I'm up in the middle of the night giving bottles and holding my 1.5-year-old that's screaming and crying. And so there's just, point is, there's not many hours to be able to get it in. So I have no choice but to say, okay, this is my vision. This is my mission. It's unwavering. And over a long period of time, we're gonna see it through.
It's only enabled by that connection to your authentic self too. I think there's a
bingo.
When you're executing on a thing that feels inauthentic, there's more anxiety and tension and desire for speed around it. And so you feel like you're losing ground. But if you
or you can't get out of your way. It's just nothing but procrastination and, you know, moving pixels on a screen.
Right. Yeah. It does. Yeah, you're right. It does expose itself at both ends of the spectrum. Well, I know we're coming to a close here. The final question that I ask everyone, to hand over the mic to you is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I'm gonna give you two questions, but they're related. They go together. Yeah, they're twins. They're brothers or sisters, siblings. Who are you when you're at your best? What are you doing? What does it feel like? Who are you? Who are you at your best? So that's the first one. And then the second question is, what gets in the way of you being at your best? What are the behaviors? What are the patterns? What are the stories? What are the beliefs that block you from fully expressing your truest best self?
You could spend
2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours on each of those questions.
I think you spend your life on the collection of them. I was reading Paul Graham's most recent essay titled Best Essay, and he had this bit in there that kind of reflected what you're saying here, where he was like, when I'm writing an essay and I'm exploring a question, there's this truth that I'm getting to. And there is a gap between my current state of expression, my current words. There's this chasm between those two things. And through words, I'm trying to work towards that truth. Mm-hmm. And I think the combination of those questions of like, who am I? And then what's getting in the way? It's like, this is the hypothetical. This is the platonic ideal. And then this is the space between how do I work through that brush? There's a connection between those two ideas.
Yeah, I love that. And something one of my coaches, Steve March, coaches and teacher, once saw is like, what are you in that space of not knowing? What is that space like? What do you do in that space where you don't know? What's it feel like in your body? What are you thinking?
That's a third question, but we'll allow it.
Yeah, but I'm just riffing on what you just shared.
That's excellent. Awesome. Well, Steve, Thank you. This was a lot of fun. Please tell your wife and kids thank you for the time.
Yes.
And yeah, looking forward to replaying and publishing this one.
Yeah. And for those in the audience, depending on when this goes live, you can learn more about me at schlaf.co, which is my personal website. You can learn more about Downshift at downshift.me. And I'm back on Twitter after roughly 8 months off. It's good to be back. So you can follow me at Schlaf, S-C-H-L-A-F.